Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell, who continues the conversation backstage exclusively for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
As President Trump was wrapping up his foreign trip last week, his administration was rocked by reports that he tried to fire the special counsel in the Russia investigation, Robert Mueller. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. As the Mueller story broke, Trump was in Davos, Switzerland, glad-handing with wealthy elites at the World Economic Forum. Trump's tax and regulatory policies have been a boon to the financial elite who gather in Davos every year, and yet somehow, Trump still managed to antagonize an otherwise friendly crowd by taking a gratuitous shot at the media.
I've always seemed to get, for whatever reason, a disproportionate amount of press or media. And throughout my whole life, somebody will explain someday why, but I've always gotten a lot. And as a businessman, I was always treated really well by the press. You know, the numbers speak and things happen. But I've always really had a very good press. And it wasn't until I became a politician that I realized how nasty, how mean, how vicious, and how fake the press can be as the cameras start going off in the back.
Wow. You have to be a real piece of work to get booed in a neutral country. Only Donald Trump could make me side with the people at Davos. It's like being at a high society gala and thinking, look at all these rich jerks, and then the Joker crashes the party, and you're like, save them, Batman! After that performance, I guess it makes sense that Trump spent the rest of his time in Davos rushing into the arms of friendly interviewers. First, CNBC anchor Joe Kernan asked Trump about his position on trade, whether he supports free trade or fair trade. And Trump gave this nonsensical answer.
I'm a free trader. Totally. I'm a fair trader. I'm all kinds of trader.
First of all, Robert Mueller will decide what kind of trader you are. Second, Trump sounds like he's reciting lyrics from the Steve Miller Band. I'm a joker. I'm a smoker. I'm also a midnight toker. In fact, many people, multiple people, call me the Space Cowboy. It's amazing how when Trump doesn't know how to answer a question, he somehow manages to take every position and no position at the same time. A similar thing happened when Trump sat down with fellow TV blowhard Piers Morgan. And for some reason, Morgan asked Trump, who has been accused by at least 19 women of sexual misconduct, if he considers himself a feminist.
Do you identify as a feminist? Are you a feminist?
No, I wouldn't say I'm a feminist. I mean, if I think that would be maybe going too far. I'm for women, I'm for men, I'm for everyone.
You don't have to ask Donald Trump if he's a feminist. That's like asking Hannibal Lecter if he's a vegan. Sometimes we can glean our answers from previous behavior. Morgan also asked Trump about a series of racist videos he retweeted from a notoriously Islamophobic group in the UK, and Trump essentially tried to claim he had no idea what he was actually retweeting.
You retweeted an organization called Britain First, one of the leaders, three times.
And this three times, boom, 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 quickly.
Right. Yeah. But this caused huge anxiety and anger in my country, because Britain First is basically a bunch of racist, fascist.
Of course, I didn't know that.
Well, that's what I wanted to clarify with you. What did you know about them when you did those?
Well, I know nothing about them. I did a retweet. You know, a retweet. Mm. Sometimes you do retweets are very. When you do your own tweeting, when you do your own social media, it's fine. When you do those retweets, they can cause problems. This was a depiction of radical Islamic.
But they were
terror.
Unverified videos. At least one of them was not what it seemed.
They are, but this was. I didn't do it. I didn't go out. I did a retweet.
Oh my God, dude! Just say you retweeted someone. Stop saying I did a retweet. That's how children talk. It's the difference between saying I went to the bathroom and I did a potty. Of course, while Trump is talking about retweets, he's also dealing with the ongoing Russia investigation led by special counsel Robert Mueller. Now, Mueller isn't just investigating alleged collusion with Russia. He's also investigating whether Trump or anyone else tried to obstruct that investigation. And last week, we got yet another lead in that obstruction case.
Breaking news tonight, the New York Times reporting President Trump ordered special counsel Robert Mueller to be fired last June and only backed down when White House counsel Don McGahn threatened to quit if he was forced to do so.
Amazing. Trump is mad that he's being investigated for obstruction of justice, so his plan to get out of it is to obstruct justice. If Trump was the captain of the Titanic, his plan would have been to hit a second iceberg. And if you think that's all dumb, that's not all, because Trump apparently also concocted a bunch of fake reasons why he thought Mueller couldn't be fair and should be fired. And those reasons are truly absurd. First, Trump said Mueller couldn't be fair because he had worked for a law firm that represented Jared Kushner. And then he said Mueller couldn't be fair because he had interviewed to be Trump's FBI director. But the dumbest reason Trump came up with is this. Trump claimed that a dispute years ago over fees at Trump National Golf Club in Sterling, Virginia, had prompted Mueller, the FBI director at the time, to resign his membership. Mueller left the club in 2011, and Trump believes he still holds a grudge against him over the matter. So you think Robert Mueller has been lying in wait all these years, quietly biding his time, so we could finally get his revenge over golf fees? What's wrong, Robert? Trump raised fees at his club. You should write an angry letter. No, I think I have a better idea. Yes. Yes, I think this will work. Bring me my 5-year hourglass. So now this brings up a simple question. Why would Donald Trump do this? Why does he keep going out of his way to interfere with the investigation? Well, there are two possible answers. One, he's guilty. Or two, he asked the FBI director for a pledge of loyalty, asked him to stop his investigation of Michael Flynn, fired the FBI director, admitted he fired him because of the Russia investigation, bragged to the Russians that he did it because of the Russia investigation, pressured the attorney general not to recuse himself, pressured the heads of the intelligence agencies to intervene, and tried to fire the special counsel who took over the Russia investigation because he's innocent? So who knows? It's one of those either ors. That's not even a full list of all the ways Trump has tried to interfere with the Justice Department or the FBI. Last week, for example, we learned that after he fired Comey, Trump called in the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, and asked him a pointed question: whom did he vote for in the 2016 election? Trump has been especially fixated on the fact that McCabe's wife ran for state senate in Virginia as a Democrat and received political donations from then-Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. Now, McCabe himself was a registered Republican as recently as 2016, but Trump cannot seem to stop obsessing over his wife's failed state senate bid. NBC News reported today that the day after he fired Comey, a furious Trump called McCabe, demanding to know why Comey had been allowed to fly on an FBI plane from Los Angeles back to Washington after he was dismissed. McCabe told the president he hadn't been asked to authorize Comey's flight, but if anyone had asked, he would have approved it. The president was silent for a moment and then turned on McCabe, suggesting he ask his wife how it felt to be a loser. McCabe replied, "Okay, sir." Trump then hung up the phone. You told him to ask his wife what it's like to be a loser? You should ask your wife what it's like to be married to one. Awful. You are awful. So naturally, all these reports have raised questions about how far Trump has gone to obstruct an investigation of him and his campaign. And today, former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer crawled out of the bushes outside the White House and tried to answer those questions. Spicer was specifically asked about the report that Trump tried to fire Mueller and said he personally could not corroborate that story.
You were in the White House at that time. Can you corroborate that story? Did the president try and fire Bob Mueller?
There is nothing that I saw, witnessed, or was near that suggests that that's true, ever.
Completely made up.
I didn't say it was made up. What I'm saying is that I didn't see anything in my tenure, nor did I talk to anybody during the time that I was there that witnessed anything similar to what that was.
So Spicer says he hasn't talked to anyone about it, but I'm not sure Sean Spicer is the most reliable source here, given that he has clearly never actually talked to Donald Trump about anything.
I have not asked the president since the last time we spoke about this. I have not asked the president. I haven't asked him. I have not talked to him about the specific qualities he's looking forward to seeing. But again, I haven't spoken to him on it. Honestly, I haven't asked him. I honestly haven't asked him that specific question. I have not had an opportunity to have that discussion. I literally have not had that kind of conversation. I have not discussed that with the president.
Even when Spicer was in the Oval Office, I'm pretty sure Trump made him wear a blindfold like he was playing pin the tail on the donkey. So there's now a clear established pattern of Trump attempting to meddle in the FBI and the Russia investigation. But one of the most fascinating things about this episode has been watching the reaction from the right. In fact, the last few days have been a very revealing look into how the right-wing propaganda machine works. Just take Fox News host Sean Hannity as an example. When the news first broke on Thursday night, Hannity did what he usually does and dismissed it.
At this hour, the New York Times is trying to distract you. They have a story that Trump wanted Mueller fired sometime last June, and our sources, and I've checked in with many of them, they're not confirming that tonight. And the president's attorney dismissed the story and says, no, no comment, we're not going there. And how many times has the New York Times and others gotten it wrong?
So that was Hannity's first response. Then about 40 minutes later, the journalists at Fox News confirmed the story, and Hannity had to issue an awkward update.
All right, so we have sources tonight just confirming to Ed Henry that, yeah, maybe Donald Trump wanted to fire the special counsel for conflict. Does he not have the right to raise those questions? You know, we'll deal with this tomorrow night. We have a shocking video of the day to bring you, by the way. This footage comes to us from Arizona, where you see that red SUV, high-speed police chase. Ultimately, the suspect's vehicle slams into another car, flips several times before coming to a stop.
Wow, I've never seen someone crash and burn like that. And the car chase video was bad, too. So, Fox News' own reporters confirmed the story. But then the next morning, Trump spoke to reporters in Davos and called the story fake news. So then Fox had to reverse itself all over again to fall in line with Trump, going against their own reporting and dismissing the story as fake.
Let's take a look at the cover of the New York Times up there in the corner, Ted, this corner over here. There's a big story that apparently the president of the United States last June wanted to fire Robert Mueller.
We heard back in June that there were talks of the president wasn't happy with Bob Mueller. What would he do?
Right.
But some new details that may or may not actually be true.
All right. Well, the president says it's fake news. That happened last June. Do you know, it's something we have to tell you about because it is a headline in the New York Times. What do you think about that? Do you even care? Something you probably do care about is immigration.
Oh, my God. They will literally do whatever Trump says. I think if Trump did actually shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue, the Fox Chiron would be Trump solves jaywalking problem in New York. Now, obviously, it's not surprising that Republicans and Fox and friends would do whatever they could to defend Trump, but what is surprising is that there are even some Democrats bending over backwards to give Trump a pass, like West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who said on Sunday that Trump firing Mueller wasn't a big deal. It's just the way he talks.
What's your reaction to the president's reported order to fire Bob Mueller? How much does that concern you?
Again, that's New York talk. I look at it strictly as the New York language that they have, which is different than most other people.
What? How do you think New Yorkers talk? Good morning, Kevin. Fire Robert Mueller. And a fine fire Mueller to you, Dave. Ah, New York. So there's now a clear pattern of the president trying to interfere with an investigation of his campaign and the people around him, and his allies in the right-wing media are either saying it's not true or admitting it and saying it's good. I don't know if he'll ever be charged with a crime, but given Trump's penchant for accidentally admitting things, there's a good chance he'll end his interview with Mueller by saying,
I'm all kinds of traitor.
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest guest hosts The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell weeknights at 10 on MSNBC. Please welcome to the show Lawrence O'Donnell, everyone. Thank you so much for being here.
I am your cheapest possible date.
You are.
You don't have to send a car.
No.
I just walk from, where were we, 8?
We're on the 8th floor.
I come up from 4.
4. They don't even let you take the elevator. They say, that's the stairs.
No, and it's, and I can wear my slippers.
You can wear your slippers. Look at that. That's wonderful.
Anchormen wear slippers.
Yeah.
That's the big secret of Anchorman Land is we're all wearing slippers under the...
No, I can't because I got to do that walk.
Oh, you do the walk.
Middle.
Yeah.
I walked out and just met you.
No, if you drop the walk...
Yeah, that's true.
Your wardrobe life becomes so simple.
Come here. Sit here.
There are times on my show where I have to do something where you see the entirety of the Anchorman. And we call those pants shows.
Oh.
I have to wear the pants that go with the suit instead of the jeans and the slippers.
Well, I did all my whole time at SNL Weekend Update, I wore jeans and sneakers.
Yeah,
because that's not a pants show.
Right. That's
historically.
Not a pants show.
One of the longest running no pants shows in history is SNL.
Yeah. You have been pantless on TV.
I have
probably
been
longer than any other man.
That's true. I want to ask you about, so you're in the building. Your show tonight, 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock, yeah.
So, and thank you so much for making the time. We're taping at 6:30 here. And how has your life been? And ours is changed. The schedule has changed in the Trump administration. How is life for you? Because you're actually doing real news as opposed to us, which is just making fun of it.
They're getting closer. I'm not sure what the difference is there, but no, it's easier and harder at the same time. The easier part is, we know what we're doing tonight.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know exactly what the pieces are, but we know it's the world of Trump. That's what we're doing every night. And you could go a couple of years ago and, you know, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you're sitting there going, okay, we've got two. We need 3 more stories.
Yeah.
Did anything happen? That we can, you know, and so that's the simplified part. The hard part is all the panic stuff, which is to say, you know, I'm on live at 10, and so there's a tweet at 8:15 that completely changes what we were going to do at the beginning of the show, or there's also the big New York Times news break or the Washington Post news break that changes everything we were planning. So those are the 3 big factors that hit us as we're approaching the hour, and then sometimes within the hour, there is, of course, the tweet that changes where we're going.
And it seems like now he's getting even more erratic as to when he tweets. You used to feel like, okay, because he wakes up so early, you don't get the 10 p.m. tweet. But now those have started coming, too.
Yeah, they've kind of... 10 p.m. has been... I've been in a safer place than most of the other anchors in the network, because he does tend to... And we now know, because of Michael Wolff's book, it's those 6:30 p.m. cheeseburgers in bed.
Yeah.
That he quiets down for me.
Right, he wants to make sure.
Yeah.
The only thing he hears there is the chewing and digesting of his burger. So, you are from Massachusetts.
Yes, sir. From Dorchester.
Dorchester. But no accent. Did you have to lose your accent for television?
As we sit here, every second, I am suppressing my native tongue.
Has it ever almost slipped out for you?
It cracks all the time. And then, the first time I ever hosted a show on MSNBC, I was substitute hosting Hardball.
Yeah.
And there's this little moment, a minute before the show, where you rehearse the introduction of the show, which ends in the punchline, "Let's play Hardball." And so I'm reading a teleprompter for the very first time in my life, and I come to that line and I say, "Let's play Hardball." And I go, oh, my God, it cracked. Oh, my God. And so I had 30 seconds before the show's going to start. And what I wanted to do is, can I do that again just to prove to myself that I can say Hardball? And we didn't have time to do that. So I spent the whole time trying to think up, okay, what's my improvised joke for having the Boston accent crack? And I didn't come up with a joke, but I did say Hardball on TV when I needed to, which was wicked hard for me to do.
I imagine that's Hardball is a really hard one.
Oh,
I want to ask before we go about is it called the Kind Fund? Is that?
Yeah, I have a fund that I started with UNICEF, and we promote it on the show where people get to contribute, and we are able to build desks in Malawi and deliver them to African schools where kids have never seen desks. And what's great about it is it not only does that wonderful thing, which the audience has kind of taken over and delivered, and we're now delivering hundreds of thousands of desks, and factories have been built, jobs created to do this, but on those days, which I'm sure you've never had, ever had, when you're questioning why you're doing this for a living.
Sure.
I can always just look at one of those desks. We have a desk up in my office there that was made in Malawi. It's one of the desks that the kids get when we deliver them. And I just look at that desk and I go, okay, you got to stay. You got to keep doing this.
Well, that's great.
The reason to do this.
And there's a lot of other reasons, too. And I'm really happy you're here tonight. Have a great show this evening.
Put me on your desperately available list. I'm just down the hall.
Oh, you're you're on our slipper list.
I already am.
You're on our slipper list. Yeah. Lawrence O'Donnell, everybody, last word. Airs weeknights at 10 on MSNBC.
Hey, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Lawrence O'Donnell from MSNBC. Lawrence, you and Seth were just talking about how crazy the news is and how that changes your daily schedule for the show. So right now it's 7:10. What needs to happen between now for you and 10 p.m. when you go live?
I haven't written a word of the show yet. And so I have to write everything I'm going to say, certainly in the first half of the show. The second half of the show tends to be lighter on script, and the staff, generally good writers and producers, tend to put that together. And it could be literally a couple of thousand words I have to write. It could be, I don't know, 1,500, I don't know. But it's the amount of script that used to take me 7 or 8 hours to write. Hmm. I have to write it at ultra high speed much later in the day because all of the Trump developments are constantly happening. They don't settle down. And the thing about political news is it used to be extremely predictable, extremely. Yeah. I mean, when I was working in the Senate, you know, we would watch like NBC News at night at, you know, like 6:30, knowing nothing else could possibly happen in Washington. Nothing can. And so in what you saw Brokaw do at that time was it. And now, you know, it's just a completely different thing. And so there's just a tremendous amount of panic writing that goes on.
Yeah. How does writing for cable news differ from writing for TV? You were a writer and producer at The West Wing for many years.
Well, it has all the same internal challenges, meaning it has all the same fights with yourself about how to get started. And I find that they interact with each other. I find that episodic television writing ended up making me a faster writer. I used to be really, really slow and work on long projects like books and screenplays and stuff. But episodic television, to me, was the tightest deadline you could ever live with. Now I have a deadline that is live. It's a much tighter deadline. And so writing is always what happens when the deadline is imposed. Mm-hmm. When we say to you, it has to be done by 10 p.m.,
yeah,
then it is going to get done by 10 p.m. If we said to you, you have 6 weeks to write exactly the same thing, you would take 6 weeks to write those same 1,000 words. And so episodic TV is one good training ground for high-speed writing, but this is a whole other thing. This is nutty. This is just insane. You know, I was complaining one day to Lorne Michaels in the elevator on the way down over this exact thing, right? And I said, you know, and it drives me crazy that what you're watching is an unrehearsed first draft, you know, because I've been writing for actors and we rehearse it and it's not a first draft and it's polished and it's all that stuff. And he said, you know, so the writing is it's such a panic. And, you know, then when I'm actually reading the teleprompter that I've written, I've forgotten some of the material and then when it comes up in the prompter, I don't like it. And I want to edit it and rewrite it. And I do all this whole rap, you know, and we hit the bottom, we hit the lobby, and Lauren just turns to me and says, well, you know, we don't do it because we're ready. We do it because it's 11:30.
His famous line about SNL. Yeah.
And I realized I heard him say that 30 years before.
Yeah,
once, and
same.
I went, oh, and really, and that was a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I needed it exactly on the day he said it to me again. Mm-hmm. And it's just that thing. It's just, I just surrender to it. Once we get down to around, you know, 10 minutes of 10, I just, there's nothing I can do.
When a breaking news story happens during your show, how does that information actually get to you? And how do things change?
Aisha, who's standing right here beside you, is the only person who's in the studio with me who's not operating a machine like a camera or a sound. And so she's got a computer there. The control room is following news. And they pump the information to her, they immediately say to me, as they did the other night, Ivanka Trump just tweeted how great Oprah was at the Globes, you know, which was a loathsome tweet from someone who's a co-conspirator in her father's, you know, sexual harassment cover-ups. And so they tell me that, and then Aisha's busy grabbing the tweet and printing it so she can literally run it to the table, hand it to me. I can look at the tweet. Invariably, in the high-speed version of this, it comes in print that is too small for me to read. And but then they at the tech people have managed to get it into a slide that they can put online. Yeah. So sometimes I can actually read it off my TV monitor, as you are reading it at home off your TV monitor. I might be reading exactly the same source. And so it's stuff in your ear. It's half sentences in your ear, that you then try to figure out, how do I phrase a statement or question about that? And, you know, I've been doing this now for about 7 years, and I still feel myself an amateur. But for the first few years, every bit of what I just described was raw panic to me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to cry and say, I can't do this. You can't change a script in the middle of, you can't do this, you know, and you just have to know that it's going to happen. I mean, there's still most of this stuff that most cable news anchors have to do, I could never do. I mean, Anderson Cooper stands out in the rain live.
Yeah, you get to stay in his studio. What are you complaining about?
Right? And they update him on how many, you know, homes have been destroyed in the flood, and he just reports that number.
Right.
I would just be like, well, we can't do television here. Are you kidding me? This is crazy.
Terrible conditions.
I can't do any of this. So most of what, you know, is required of someone in this kind of job, I cannot actually do, which is the crazy improvised, you know, stuff that happens.
When I worked in cable news, one of my biggest takeaways was learning how long a minute is.
Yeah.
People saying, we need this in a minute. And I'm like, well, there's no way. And it's like, oh no, 60 seconds, actually, you can refresh your graphic. You can get a clip ready.
Well, here's, you want to really experience how long a minute can be. You've got a minute left in a segment where you have nothing to say. It's like, and you can't think of another
eternity
question for these guests or guests, and you're just going, and it's a nightmare. The minute in particular is a nightmare because it's going to take me 28 seconds to ramble into something resembling a question, and then there's no time for then I've eaten up the answer time. But that to me is the worst minute. The minute where, oh my God, this whole thing might go dead. Mm-hmm. It might go to dead air because I am out of material. My brain is empty and we're out of material, and you guys don't have a commercial ready for another minute. Oh my God.
Well, I hope that doesn't happen tonight. I will let you run. Now it is about 17.
Not one word of the TV show has been written. Not one word.
Go write some of those words,
when
Lawrence.
You see me looking right at you and talking, that means it's in the prompter and it means I wrote it. And if you see me go to the guests really quickly tonight, it means I didn't write anything. I don't have anything. Yeah. We're just going to do a Drunks at the Bar show where we sit around, you know, just talk. You know, there's
throw
no,
up some tweets.
No script. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming up here, especially in the slippers, which is a great...
You are the most conveniently located show.
That's right.
I could possibly do.
That's right. Yeah. Well, thank you for making the elevator ride up.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.